Now, when we come back to the poem, if we just take a look at the whole poem for a moment. We've got this poem written by Taliesin that is about a journey with Arthur. About going in, it's so going into the ship of Arthur, going into the other world, into Annwn, Annwn. To free a prisoner, to find the cauldron of inspiration. Going through various experiences and different castles in that process. And in a way eventually coming down to the fundamentals of existence, coming to the place where who created who, what is the nature of water, air, fire and earth, the fundamental elements. And it ends with a sort of, with a hint at a further mystery. The saint's grave is hidden deep in the ground. And this image of Christ is my guardian, Christ is my protector and guide. And a lot of play in the latter part of the poem about those who know, as opposed to clerics of weak intent or monks who huddle together and don't know things. Now the poem begins by praising the sovereign, by coming into the place of sovereignty and encompassing the margins of the world. It ends by sort of inquiring into the four elements. So there are a lot of resonances really with this basic practice we've been doing with the poem. But within that, and when that's established, what the poem then kind of invites us to consider the story of the prisoner, and that story resonant with the Welsh story of Pwyll and Pryderi, or connected to that story. It takes us further in into the cauldron itself, where we've got this mysterious cauldron, this breath warmed by the breath of nine maidens. And then we have this image of the sword of light and Clemenach, the leaper. And then we have this, towards the end of the poem, we have this strange thing of becoming Pen Anuven. To become the possessor of the cauldron, you have to become Pen Anuven, connected with or becoming a chieftain of Anuven, a chieftain of the other world. And in order to, in a way, if you are going to be Pen Anuven, you must allow the cauldron to boil your food, and only it is a great act of courage. So it will only boil the food of a hero, heroine. Someone who can stay with the cauldron and stay with its movements and stay in its heat and its fire until the food is cooked. But to be Pen Anuven is also somewhat connected with this idea of who created who, or knowing the hour when the chick is hatched, the chick is born. It's also connected with the great sea of stars and this image of the great brindled ox who turns the universe. Now, if we come back to this image of Arthur, the variation of the word Arthur in Celtic is the bit would be bear. It's the word Ath, and the, or Ath and of Ath. We find a similar figure to Arthur in the fourth branch of the Mabinogion, where we come across Math, son of Mathonwy, bear, the son of the one who is like a bear. So in a certain sense, we make a journey, having set up, having encompassed the land, having acknowledged the sovereign, having brought the energies together. What then happens is we make a journey with this ancient king in his ship, accompanied by many. So it's a few come back, but many go. And the first movement in particular is related to the finding of the prisoner. Who is called, who is sort of the first prisoner. This is the imprisoned son of light, called the faithful youth. Who in a way stands for all imprisonment, all places where consciousness is caught or trapped or lost. And so it's the song of the prisoner guides us into the depths, and yet the prisoner sings because of the raid upon Anuvan. So it takes us into this paradoxical kind of place. So it takes us into this mystery of the wound is also the freeing or liberating energy, if held in a certain way. Now this idea of the bear king, or the bear who guides us into the depth, is actually a very ancient idea. It's much older than these stories. One of the very old places we find it in is in the teachings of Parmenides of Elea, who was a pre-Socratic philosopher around about the time of Homer. So we're way back in the Bronze Age. Now, Parmenides is a priest of Apollo Ulis, the priest of the son of light, who Ulis means the god who kills and makes alive again. So Parmenides is a servant, if you like, of an archetypal energy, archetypal figure, who is the son of the mother. Apollo is the son of light, but he's also the son of the mother. He's also Christ, and there's a very strong relationship in the figure in Christ later on. So this is in the poem of Parmenides, which is extraordinary poem, where he has this vision of being carried in a chariot by the daughters of the sun deep into the earth, into the place where the sun comes from, into the chasm where from which the sun arises, where he finds two great doors that have to be, and a goddess guarding, the goddess Themis, the goddess of justice, guarding the door, who has to be persuaded to let him pass. And he is drawn by the chariots into the presence of a nameless goddess, in a way into the presence of the deep mother. And Deep Mother tells him many things, but basically she tells him, the principal thing that she tells him is that all his experiences are true. She calls him young man, Kouros. So in a sense, he stands in that moment for the Son of Light, who is being taught by his mother, and taught that all experience is true. Now, Parmenides develops really this method, this way of being between the worlds, based on his vision. And the poem is very complicated, but he also shares his vision of the universe with us. And his vision of the universe is the universe as a great sphere in which everything is interconnected. And that underneath everything, he says, there is a great stillness, something he calls Heishia. And this great stillness, he says, is the true nature of things. And all the movements of the universe, he says, are but the exchange of bright color. So all the movements of our lives, all the movements of the universe, he says, is the exchange of bright color. Not minimizing that at all, but underneath it is the deep stillness. And so the path of the base is a way of being with the deep stillness and being with the exchange of bright color. In a sense, being at times the son or daughter of light, at other times being the deep mother. The deep mother is the stillness underneath everything, the ground from which everything comes. In Buddhist tradition, you'd call it Prajna Paramita, the womb of the Buddhas. The emptiness, the voidness, the out of which everything comes. So when we make this exercise of representing the sphere and being with the stillness and being, we are both with the stillness, the emptiness, the voidness, and then we are with the exchange of bright color, which is the movements that then happen. So in that moment we're following the path of the bear, we're practicing Heishia, the inner stillness, allowing things to happen, participating in them. Now this process of descent that he talks about, which is the other thing that we've practiced all this time, is, you know, we can use drums, whistles, all kinds of things to help us do that, to help us disrupt in a way the outer dialogue of the mind. But the principal practice, central practice, is that place where we just come into our senses, connect our senses with awareness, and then allow ourselves to, in a way, to be led. This is this journey that you see Parmenides doing, where he's led by the daughters of the sun. He's led by the, who are taking him to the house of the sun, that is the house of night. So this place of going in and down to the source of light, that is also the deepest, darkest place. So very simply what we do is, and as we do this, we don't split the world, we take the world with us. because we don't disconnect from our senses, but we become more and more present in our senses. But allowing our senses to take us into the center of ourselves, into the deep place of the body. So letting sound and vision and touch and smell and taste travel with us. So in a way, whenever we make this journey, whenever we go in a way with Arthur into the depths, we go into the places we bring with us, rather. So we bring with us everything that's in the ship. All the beings of our life travel with us. Only 7 return, because we don't need all the qualities of our lives. What returns is what's essential for the next bit of our life. But we start off with all our clutter, all the things that are bugging us, or we're attached to, or we need, or all that's in the ship with us. But as we go down, you know, in this particular poem, there are things we have to get past. So the version, so the castle of frustration in Parmenides' poem is this place where there are this closed door, and this goddess Themis, who's the goddess of justice, who is like the sentinel, which is another version of the sentinel. She has to be parlayed with, she has to be related to, she has to be persuaded. We can't get past that by force. And it's the daughters of the sun, the Parmenides' poem, it's the daughters of the sun that persuade him. So it's that larger energies that so we get past the castle of frustration. If we throw ourselves against the wall, or we throw ourselves against this door, we just get more and more frustrated. We have to stay there and pause there and allow the deeper energies to do the work, to find the way that unlocks the door this time. It's never a formula, it's always a relationship. At that point. And then the interesting thing in the Parmenides poem, which has a lot of resonances with the Thomas Rhymer ballad, is that he is taken to a crossroads of three ways, and where the goddess stands, and sort of, and very interesting. I mean, you know, there's no direct connection between the ballad of Thomas Rhymer and Parmenides' poem. They're separated by thousands of years, but they're incredible. But because of the deep aspects of the psyche are similar, you find similar images. So Thomas Rhymer is carried on a horse by the Queen of Fairies. Parmenides is carried in a chariot by the daughters of the sun, who take him, you know, they both end up at a place where there's a choice of roads and a goddess for Parmenides, fairy queen for Thomas the Rhymer. And in both cases, both people discover that there is apparent choice, but actually the only choice is forward into the deeper. And in the Parmenides poem, he says it's sort of one way is the way of truth and falsity, and she then goes on to explain how there's no such thing as truth and falsity. Or the other way is the place of ambivalence, what she calls it, the twin-headed path, where you keep running round in circles trying to work out what's true. And she actually says in this deep place there is only one way forward. Now, in Thomas Rhymer ballad, you get the image of there's the path of wickedness, or there's the path of righteousness. Or is the winding road over the hill that follows the Ferny Brae, that follows the water of life, that leads over the hill that you can't see. And so extraordinarily, these two, you know, this very early poem, Bronze Age poem, probably 15th century common era ballad, are saying the same things in very, very similar imagery. Yeah.
Reminds me of the tree of life and the tree of good and evil.
Yeah, completely so. That's right. Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's a sort of, you can, if you go into, that's really accurate, because you can go into those places of good and evil that are just opposites, yeah. Or you follow the living tree that actually takes you beyond the opposites into the mysterious place.
Yeah.
And in a way, you know, what's interesting about what's useful about, we were talking yesterday about what, you know, what's the usefulness of the reading, these things are helpful because they show sometimes in quite different language things that are deeply true about our relationship to the depth in us. So when you see that in a Bronze Age poem and the Ballad of Thomas Rhymer are very similar things being said, you can see that what's being said is something very fundamental about human nature. Because there's no way that Parmenides is a direct influence upon Thomas Rhymer. Whoever composed the Ballad of Thomas Rhymer was just working with their local traditions and ideas and wouldn't have had any access to ancient Greek literature. And yet somewhere the same thing is being said. You know, but so but there's this, and underneath it, there's this process really that we're looking at, whether we find it in the Pradayanun, or this place of going into depths, guided by and this constellation of masculine energy and feminine energy. And so these are archetypes, these figures. The young man, the Kouros, and the goddess, these are archetypes, not literal men and women. So it does mean we have to work, and just as in the poem, we work with the nine maidens and the cauldron, we also have to work with the Sword of Light and Chominac. So what these various things are talking about is, as we go into the depths, we encounter the archetypal masculine, the archetypal feminine, in whatever form they meet, and a certain marriage has to occur. And the other thing that happens when you do this is that there's an experience of liberation. Somebody is freed from prison. The other thing that happens is you find your way forward. And where it takes Parmenides to is this kind of sense of the sense that everything is connected, and he has to keep practicing this practice of deep stillness and follow the mysterious process that keeps on happening to him. But in that process, he has to encounter the energies of life and death. So this experience of things dying and coming alive again. That experience of constant change, just like the Buddha's notion of anicca, impermanence. Things are constantly, in this exchange of bright color, things are constantly dying and reappearing. So that one of the things that we... But what helps us to be with that is that place of deep stillness underneath everything. If we don't have the deep stillness, we don't have the ground to be with the exchange of bright color. And we get lost in that. And in a way, and of course we habitually get lost, that happens all the time. So what we have to do is to keep coming back into the senses, back into this... into the protected space, and then following the process that arises.
Are you saying the bright colours are like the sword?
Well, it would be everything. The bright colours, not just the sword, it would be everything, because it's all the colours of life, right? So it could be, it's not just the light, colours could be dark as well, in a way, it would be better to take the bright bit out, and so it would be the exchange of colour, because colours can be muddy, colours can be dark, colours can be bright. It's all a kind of a constant flux and movement in some ways.
So it's the stillness enables the ability to hold the other bit, is that?
Yeah, that's right, exactly. No, that's absolutely right, yeah, because without the stillness, without finding that, because what happens in the Parmenides poem, it's interesting because it's at a crossroads place, you know, which is, you know, and of course we keep coming to the crossroads all the time. We're always at the crossroads at some level. And so at that point, you know, there are various choices. One is the twin-headed place where you run back and forth between opposites. The other place is when you're trying to decide something is not true. So destroy something. So there's one hand you can, right, that's not right, this is right. Or the other one, like, oh, I don't know what's right. And it's that quality of the Deep Mother, that goddess of stillness, that then says, no, none of those things lead anywhere. You have to be, everything is true. Everything is true. Everything you're experiencing is true. But in order to be with that, you have to be with her. You have to be with that deep stillness and allow it to direct you. So you have to keep, in a way, you have to really trust. It's that old phrase that those who are trained at Karuna have heard so many times, trust that process. You have to trust the awareness. Trust what is met when you're aware. And let it lead you onward.
But really, no paths lead anywhere, do they? Really.
No, that's right.
It's actually about staying in the heart.
It is about staying. In a certain sense, you stay there. You don't actually. That's what he's trying to convey. But it's all the exchange of bright colour.
Yeah.
That you're actually in the still place, in the center place, in that middle place. It's that middle place, the center of the sphere, where everything happens.
Is that a bit like the 7 years?
Yes, it's a bit like that. It's sort of, so what you see, with Thomas the Rhymer is he goes over into the mysterious place. So we don't know what happens to him there, right? Because he's in the place of mystery, and he changes by being in that place. It's not like he goes anywhere in a certain way, but by going into the mysterious place, by following the process, the 7 years is a bit like what happens when seven come back from one of the castles, right? So a process of transformation happens, and so what's back, and with in the Thomas Rhymer ballad, he comes back dressed in green with green shoes. He's connected to the deep life of the land, and he now has the tongue that cannot lie. He sees and he speaks. He speaks with the voice of the fairy queen. He speaks with the voice of the goddess. What he names is true. You know, so the tongue that cannot lie is the same place of everything is true. So as he speaks, so is it true. Because he's speaking from that deep place, from that experience, that deep place of the heart, that deep place of the center somewhere. Now, where the poem and things like the so if I just get quite personal at the moment, one of the things that happens as we pursue this ourselves, as we try and make sense of these various things we've looked at these past 2 years, is you find a particular pieces of writing or things to continue to talk to you. So for me, the Parmenides poem is something I don't visit a lot these days, but I used to work a lot with because it spoke a lot to me. Obviously, the poem Prithionan has spoken a lot to me. That's where, you know. So the also Tamlin ballad and the ballad of Thomas the Rhymer speak to me. They're things that I have found. But the key thing with reading is to find readings or things that speak back to you that are alive in some way. And it doesn't have to be anything we've looked at over these past 2 years. It could be anything, you know. But in a way, it's something that helps remind you of this process. Mm-hmm. That is, and the somewhere has been composed by people who have followed a similar process. And one of the kind of curious things that happens, I think, then when you look at this older material, what you discover is that you find similarities in the material. I mean, they're culturally massively different, but you find somewhere that, okay, well, that looks like, that reminds me of what was happening in that place.
Because when you're talking about the seven, I immediately think about Bojangles' practice in life.
Yeah.
Which are, you know, those are the seven that come back, really.
That's right. Yes, exactly. Yes, completely, right, because they're the essentials, right, so they're the energies that, exactly, they clear everything out of the way and you come back. Well, these are the energies that come with you, that help to constellate the continuing kind of journey. You know, the life story of the Buddha is an interesting one in relation to this. The Buddha is another such figure, you know, kind of who strives to solve the sea. You know, the whole point of these journeys, why do these journeys happen at all, is because we ask the question, what is this all about? How can we solve suffering? In a way that question of the Buddha's is like the him hearing the song of the prisoner. Yeah. How can the prisoner be freed? How can the... You know, how can we solve the knot of human suffering? You know, that's the same, you know, very different language, very different time, but a similar question. And then, you know, if we follow the journey of the Buddha as much as we know it, we see these places where he does try out these places of righteousness and sort of and eventually comes to the middle path. You know, he comes to the path that combines the opposites. Yeah. You know, and the sort of and bizarrely, there's that strange image of the rose apple tree. You know, we have this kind of, you know, so the apple, we have this in the ballads, we have these images of roses and apples, and you know, so these just strange synchronicities that the thing that keys him into the path is this, the middle way, is this, remember sitting under the rose apple tree and the encounter with the young woman who gives him rice milk, the encounter with the divine feminine. So there's a really strange similarity again, both with Parmenides and Thomas the Rhymer. Really strange, you know, in the sort of, not strange in a way. It is because we're dealing with these deep archetypal things that come up in every culture. And then, what the Buddha has to do in his journey, having found that middle place, that place where you sit in the middle of the world, he sits literally between earth and heaven at the Bodhi tree. He sits with the great sphere of the world. And he has to sit there in stillness, receiving everything, trusting everything. And this constant thing that happens around Mara, where he says, I know you, Mara. I know, nothing is alien to me. I know what's happening. I accept this into my heart. I trust the process. And so we have this process of him sitting, if in a way, in the cauldron, in a way, aligned with the tree. And literally between the earth and the sky, and you have this moment where right at the dawn time, where he sees where the morning star appears, and the moment of full enlightenment opens, and the deep mother, the earth, he puts his hands upon the earth, and the deep mother sanctifies him, ratifies him. So he unites the height and the depth in that moment. He becomes the living son of light. Who it was then this radiant being, and you know, one of the first stories you get about the Buddha is when he's walking from the place of enlightenment. After he sits around, you know, if ages he sits there and doesn't know, and has to be persuaded by a Brahma god to go and teach. And the first person who encounters him is drawn to his radiance. Why are you? Who is your teacher? You know, the Brahmin who encounters him says, "Who is your teacher, you radiant youth?" He calls him Radiant Youth, so he is, you know, he is this kind of archetypal figure. He is the young son of light somewhere, and who is bringing that kind of quality of enlightenment. You get this phrase enlightenment, you know, so he is literally in a way, the son of light, bringing illumination. And like all religious stories that are owned by major religions, what happens is the deeper dynamics of the feminine continually get pushed away, and then so because he is only the son of light because the mother, the deep mother, has ratified him in that process. He is only the son of light because he has incorporated he's received the nourishment of the mother, of the young woman who brings in the rice milk, who therefore teaches him how to sit underneath the apple tree. The rose apple tree, just like the fairy queen, you know, the fairy queen takes Thomas Rhymer underneath the apple tree, feeds him, makes love with him, becomes one with him, and then he can take the middle way, the road into the source of life. And in a way, you see, this is a potent, if you like, universal process that we're following, and so and then which is really held in these practices.
It reminds me also, It's in the fourth branch of the Madhubani.
Yep.
And the main character, one of the central characters, I can't remember his name, but he looks for his son.
Yeah, Gwydion is this, yes.
Gwydion, he looks for his son, and he's been transformed into an eagle.
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he's at the bottom of the tree.
Yeah.
And he's really sort of his sorrow.
Yeah.
He's really his sorrow. He's just filled with sorrow for
his son. That's right.
And the flesh of the eagle starts to drop down.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that as well.
Yes, it is. And the eagle comes down progressively and eventually comes down and down and down and lands in his lap. And as you see, and it's a bit like the Pietà image you get with Christ and Mary. So he comes out and becomes human and becomes embodied in that process. Mm-hmm. And in a way, this is the Welsh version of the Son of Light taking on flesh. Mm-hmm. He is the great hawk, the great eagle somewhere, because he's flown out of the world, but he comes down. It's like the starfire coming down into the body, into combining with the energies of the earth, because he's sitting in the deepest place. Yeah, it's again very, very similar. Right, so these are all ways of illustrating a process.
I was just thinking about this talk on death. It's like he fell in love with life when his child comes.
Yeah.
He becomes a good person.
Yes, he does, because up until this point, Gwydion is this arch manipulator, yeah. Right, trying to control everything. And
his heart is
totally. By the death of his son, that's right, and it's his longing and his surrender. He surrenders it because he has to let go of all his manipulation in order to do this. So it's that place where he just gives up manipulation. And he just has to trust the energies of the universe, and he's making his prayer, his cry, really. And in a way, that's the other important thing about this work. It's this idea of prayer.
So for me, it occurs to me that there's a link between death,
yep.
and love.
Yep.
Because the death of the eagle, their son, that. Quite remote,
yep.
Ending up the story. If the child comes back, that
yeah.
So he values the life so much. He then becomes changed. It's through the death of that.
Yeah. Story. Yes, it is right. No, it's exactly it is exactly like that, because what happens in that particular story, if you remember, Gwydion has created a wife. He and Math created a wife for Chlai.
Yeah.
And it's because she gets attached to somebody to the Gronu Pedro, he is killed as a result of that, and lots of things we could look into that. But the key bit around Gwydion is that all his schemes come to nothing. Right. So this has been because he tricks the mother of the child. He tricks her into getting the name. He tricks her into arming the son so he can become a true kind of warrior. He finds a way. She finds a way of getting him a wife, because Ariane Rudd won't give it because she's constantly being so constantly in this story. This is the masculine at war with the feminine. Denying the right of Ariane, or the mother, to and getting past her, manipulating past her, even to the extent of finding a woman, creating a wife. You know, so this is, and this other place none of it works, right? Because he dies, he's killed, and so all Gwydion's magic is abandoned at this point, and he has to sit there. He has to sit there in a way. He has to sit there as the mother. He has to be the grieving mother. He has to sit there as the mother who loves and longs for her child. He has, in a certain sense, to become the mother. And it's a subtle story, that fourth branch, because in the story is all about the dislocation of the masculine and the feminine. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things, if you remember, in the earlier on in the story, Gwydion conspires with his brother to rape Gawain, who is the handmaiden of Math, the great king, And but as a result, they're punished by both being turned into animal, and they keep changing their sex. Yeah. So they have to really learn about masculinity, femininity, learning at the, you know. So they have to, and so the ingredient learns something, but doesn't learn enough because he continues to do his thing, really. Mm-hmm. So in the end, it's like he almost has to, so the final bit of the punishment, in a sense, is he has to really incorporate the feminine. He has to really abandon his resistance, his hatred of the mother, because he has to become the mother. You know, and that, you know, that image is particularly given this is a medieval, you know, medieval story. That image of Mary holding the child,
Michelangelo, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Probably wouldn't. This would have been before Michelangelo, so they wouldn't have known that, because that's more Renaissance. This is a bit pre-Renaissance, this story. So they wouldn't have known this, but they would. But that image of the mother receiving the child and holding the child is a strong image. So that's the image that we're given about of Gwydion, in a sense, as the mother receiving the child and bringing him back to life, nourishing him so he comes back to life. So in that process, not only does Clyde come back to life, but Gwydion also is finally redeemed, in a sense, because he has to abandon all his artifice and skill and rely on this place of longing and prayer. Now that's the other bit that with this kind of work and with, you know, shamanic work across the world, one of the key things that happens is you pray a lot. Now prayer for us is a bit complicated because of Christianity, which is it, but prayer in a way is the movement of the heart. It's asking the universe for help. And this whole practice that we're looking at this weekend is about surrendering and asking for the help of the wider universe. So helping, asking the angels, helping the deeper energies to come in, helping what, you know, so constantly being in that place of Gwydion, really, and saying, please, please help me. So that place of stillness and surrender is the central place we have to keep coming back to.
Is there another word that could be used?
Prayer.
You know, it's a whole,
it does have that.
Kind of sticky, sort of. I don't know.
It is sticky, isn't it? I know it's.
Shamanism. What do you
call
it? Bring
a
prayer.
Does it have a different? Yeah. Well, they would call them prayers because they don't have, you know, in their own language, if you translate that into English, because they don't have association. You could call it talking to spirits, I suppose. You could call it, you know, it's sort of...
petitioning.
You could call it petitioning. In the Celtic tradition, they're very much prayer. They are just called prayers because they...
Blessing.
You could... Yeah, but blessing is an aspect of prayer. That when you do, blessing is more when you're putting energy out, right? So it's like making a request, right? So it's an act of surrender where you're asking for something, and you could just call it asking, I suppose, asking the spirits. You know, it's, you know, that's what a shaman would say. They are speaking to the spirits and asking the spirits
to surrender.
Yeah. But it's an act of asking, I suppose, right? So a shaman would say, "Well, I talk to the spirits. I ask them for help." Mm-hmm. So I suppose we could take the prayer word away. We could just say, "Well, yeah, it's." But what we do is we ask the spirits for help. We ask the gods for help. We ask the universe for help.
They say, "Send a prayer."
Yeah. I mean, in most shamanic traditions, they do is with. Because they don't have our particular problems, because our, you know, the in a way, in some ways, that's a reason for using the word prayer. In some ways, that we struggle with the stickiness of it, because the problem with prayer, as we are taught it, if we have been taught it, is it's this rather formal kind of formal kind of thing where you're asking God to forgive you because you're sinful. You know, that's sort of the framework of it. That's why it's sticky. It's something wrong with me, please. You know, and the Christian prayers have a format of I am a sinner, you know, and sort of please help me to be good. And
I beseech you.
It's like, you know, and it's sort of, That's right, exactly. So, whereas in a more shamanic version, it's much more talking to the spirits and asking the spirits for help and listening to the spirits. Mm. So it's like conversation, really.
I suppose there's something for me about the thing of doing a lot of reading around Teresa of Avila.
Oh, yeah.
She does a lot of that. I beseech and I'm not worthy and all that sort of thing. And there's something very beautiful in that intention that she, where it's coming from, which is, it's not about, my understanding of what she's saying, it's not about kind of making herself small in a way, or making her, but it is about a kind of act of real humility, of something of, there's something about in relation to something that is bigger than
something quite beautiful about it. Just looking
through that kind of Catholicism.
Yeah.
Something very.
The thing that's interesting about Teresa of Avila, though, she's somebody with tremendously good self-esteem. Because there's other versions, a wonderful story of Teresa of Avila where she's crossing a stream and she falls in, and God says, "Thus do I treat my friends." She's fallen in, and God says this, sort of, and so she says, "Well, that's why you haven't got very many then, isn't it?" So she talks back to God as well, so there's a sort of, in a way, you could sense if you read about Teresa, this is a woman with enormous energy and power, and who probably had a good sense of self-esteem, and therefore her becoming humble and using it as a humility wouldn't take her into sort of a regressive madness. I think one of our problems with that bit of Christian prayer is, of course, it takes us into the places where we really do believe that we're shit, and can imprison us there if we're not careful. So it's again, prayer practice of whatever kind, which is, I think, really conversation. If we could best call it conversation with the spirits, or conversation with the archetypes or the divine, right? So that it's about speaking and listening. Now, in that story of Gwydion, where he's in a very powerful situation, he's crying out for help in his longing. I mean, there's there's a great Hasidic rabbi called Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, who used to do this when he was really in trouble. He used to do this thing he called the silent scream, where he would scream, wouldn't do anything audibly, but he would scream in his imagination. He would scream out to the divine, increasing the scream, increasing it until it literally sort of internally blew him up into a kind of place of surrender, where he would just let all his emotions kind of come through it, and by not letting it out audibly, it would sort of internally kind of explode. So he would eventually just be surrendered into the kind of divine. Now, he was sort of interesting, Nachman, because his thing is, you should pray for everything. There's a great story about Nachman where somebody come, where a very pious kind of Hasid comes to him and says that he wants to learn to pray, and he says, "Well, what do you want to pray about?" He says, "I want to pray that the Messiah comes to earth. I want to pray that all the children of Israel are taken back to Israel. I want to pray that the third temple is rebuilt, and peace comes to all the peoples of the earth." And Nachman listens to him going on like this, and eventually says, and grabs hold of his coat and says, "That's a terrible coat. Why don't you pray for a new coat?" And the point he's making there is that you get smaller, don't become grandiose, but get real. Actually, and he says this beautiful thing of that even that every blade that grafts, that grows, draws its life from God. So as a human being, everything that you need is drawn from God. So pray for everything that you need. So ask, get into the conversation. And anyway, that's, as we form the form, as we pray the practices, the other bit where we give it life is by letting our needs and our issues and our struggles come into it, and letting us have that conversation with the beings that help us when we come into this kind of state of presence. And keep ourselves in the conversation, keep talking, keep listening. Yeah.
And I've been experiencing a similar quality of stillness in our garden and
yeah.
the land.
Yeah.
And
And what I'm experiencing is a kind of, it's not, I know it, but it's a more, a direct experience of when I allow myself to really sink down into that. It's probably what you've just been saying, but sink down into that stillness. There is so much support available.
Yeah, that's right,
it's
absolutely.
Just, oh my God, there's so much love, there's so much support.
Yeah, that's right.
It's just in the land.
Yeah.
And it is that thing of, I think it's that thing of how I separate myself off. It is me that separates myself off from me.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. And it's always there. That's the thing, that's right. And that's the great thing, isn't it? So when you remember, it's just there again.
And it's in, for me, I suppose what I'm doing is I'm doing a lot of observing of nature just out the garden window. And it's using that thing of the flutter of a bird, or it's that, there's just that moment of,
Well, the thing is, when we're aligned and centered like that, we're connected to everything. So that flutter of the bird, that otherwise you may not notice because you won't be engaged with it, that opportunity passes you by. When you're engaged and present in that, the bird touches your heart.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're touched, you're engaged, you're in the conversation in some ways. It's really true.
It's sort of like when I was a few years ago, it's sort of, I hear the birds much more now, but there was a time when I didn't hear the birds at all.
Mm.
And it was in my meditation. I knew when I'd actually settled.
Yeah.
It was the point when I heard the bird. It was at that point I was in connection.
Right.
It was sort of like it just kept on happening.
Mm.
Kept on happening.
Yeah. I'm just sort of thinking there is a real skill in being able to pray and also to listen.
Yeah.
Because when one's in the shit or with people who are really in deep distress, they may be asking a lot. You know, a lot for help anyway.
Yes, that's true, yeah.
Not. But it seems to me, and I know I do it too, that I'm very narrow in what I'm looking for. And I don't open my ears to something other than just this, because I want that to be solved, that which is hurting.
Yeah.
Mm. That's quite a difficult skill to learn. I mean, I think
it is, and I think in a way that's why this whole process we're talking about that says really, if you engage with anything, you have to engage with everything. Right, so in a sense, this idea of the sphere and that which holds the sphere, which, and this is in a way the great sphere of the universe, we could say. Right, so by practicing in this way, we say that any issue that you look at can only be solved by aligning with everything. You know, so you, as you align, you get bigger, you get the help, you pray, you do whatever really feels right as you follow the process. But actually, you have to lean back into that bigger, deeper kind of place.
Now, I think one of the problems with our form of therapy is that it comes from a similar place of that quite reductive Western mind, in a way. And I'm beginning to think that our forms of psychotherapy and therapy and stuff are about fixing the problem.
Yeah.
Becoming much more about that, or even focusing on the suffering, when really what we need to be doing is
that's right.
Connecting with that wider sphere somehow.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know, but that's certainly where I feel like I'm moving towards. Because I don't feel like the staying with the suffering. Of course, it's like honouring the suffering, but I don't actually know that that's helpful anymore.
No, I agree with you, but you know, suffering has to have its place, and the place has to be there, but it has to be held in a wider field, deeper field.
I resonate with
that.
I never got that. Specifically about core process, but
right.
I'm talking about
therapy in general.
Something about, you know, it comes from that culture, is disconnected from this.
The problem with the Brahma Viharas, I have a problem with the Brahma Viharas. It's because they're too cognitive an idea. Well, you can use, but they're different from the Four Kings idea, right? So that for me, they're different from what we're talking about. They're different what they're talking about because they are. Obviously, you can work with them. They're practices that you can work with, but they're not archetypal forms that open imagination. They don't engage the imagination. They engage the mind. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems I think they have is they. Because they're connected with cognitive ideas of goodness. So I have to be met a kind. Now, they don't have to be like that. I know if you've worked with them as a practice, that's an integrator to them.
I also work with the near and far enemies as well.
Sure. So but you, but you're a very experienced advanced practitioner, right? Both as therapist and as practitioner. So you're holding that not as. More commonly, I come across people holding them as concepts of how they should be. Mm-hmm. Right now, you've worked with them in a really different way, right? So you, when you work with metta, you'll also be working with your indifference and cruelty as well as, yeah. You know, and letting all that in. Mm-hmm. Whereas the problem with them, if people haven't done that depth of work on them, is they are trying to be kind or they're trying to be. Mm-hmm. Trying to be compassionate, and it creates a dissociation between that and the shadow kind of energies. Whereas when you're holding these energies, these more primal energies that are about the elements, that are about the energy of fire and water and earth and air, then they hold within them a whole spectrum of experiences that can then come in and inform the sphere. So I think there's, again, it's just how things get held, I think, in some ways.
How things are taught
as well. But I think what you find universal are not concepts. Concepts are never universal. What you find universal is images that come out of the deep places. You know, So that sense of the four kings or the four angels or the four guardian spirits or the four directions, of course, are, you know, that's something that's centrally human, that comes up in different cultures and in different ways. And in a certain sense, you can, of course, work with the Brahma Viharas, but only in a way if you've really understood that the middle way, which is about letting opposites be together and not trying to split the world. Now, one of the problems all religions have their kind of shadow sides. One of the problems of Buddhism is the sitting back from experience and not fully entering the middle way. It's the Buddha before he enters. It's the Buddha before when he's still trying to get out of the world. So that place where you, because we're talking about things that are complex, right? Because we both have to simultaneously hold the wider sphere, but not dissociate. So when we talk about holding it all and letting the energies, that place of stillness that happens takes us more deeply into relationship with everything, including the problem, but not just the problem. So it's the opposite of the dissociated, no, I'm going to go into the peaceful place and not be with us and leave it alone. So actually, because what happens is when we're present in this larger thing, we get present to everything, but everything is present to everything. And so in a way, that pain becomes more visible. But it's a moving pain held by energies that are much more than pain. Anyway, we're at lunchtime, so let's come back to this after lunch.
You were going to, we're going to bring us some prayers for that. I'd like to see how a prayer could be.
Well, I think what we might look at is have a look at. Well, I have had a look at it. I'm going to look at the idea of them, but not the actual Celtic prayers because they're too looked at them. I might use Bob's prayer a little bit because that's quite nice. Problem with the Celtic prayers is that they are kind of nice, except that they say things like sort of protect me from the malice of women, and protect me and so that whole they are Christian Celtic prayers. So that
that's
and that yeah. And that taint is in them. So they actually, when I looked at them, I thought, oh, these aren't quite as useful as I thought. So I'm going to look at one of the prayers of Isabel Gaudí. And actually, what we may redo the meditation on Isabel Gaudí, which might be a nice thing to do, because she's a.
Make sure I don't lie down.
Yeah, well, I'll record it. Yeah, well, I'll record it. There's done to make sure. So I don't know how we missed that, but because she's quite an important figure, really, in all of this.